This is Dr. Z, Zachary Brooks, and this show is called The People Behind the PhDs. This is Dr. Z, Zachary Brooks, and welcome to part 3 of the interview with Dr. Jenna Klusterman, who uses radios to investigate the universe, and she studies star formation in the Milky Way at the University of Southern Indiana in Evansville, Indiana. There's a few seconds of overlap, so we can pick up right where we left off in The People Behind the PhDs. Stories. Stories are humanity's original technology, so I'm proud to carry on the traditional technology and share this story with you. Whether you're on an iPhone or an Android, whether you're on Apple, Spotify, or another podcast service, whether you're at home, in your car, at work, on public transportation, working out, or just walking around, I dedicate my shows to you. Dr. Z Productions and Podcasts, Consequential Stories for Life.
That I was kind of considering going back to it, I got an email from the professor that I had been working with as an undergrad saying that she had some extra money and would I like to come back and work for her. So I did that.
You went back to Berkeley?
To Berkeley, and I like to call it my post-baccalaureate.
Okay.
So I did my post-bac at Berkeley, and I think very quickly I realized that either I had to find something else to do or go to grad school because there was, you know, you can do a year or two as a post-bac, but there's no room for advancement in that particular position. You could really get stuck. And not that I'm like looking to climb the corporate ladder or anything like that, but you're on soft money that, you know, the job could end at any time. And so it really was, if I don't go to grad school, I need to be thinking about where my career is headed. So the easiest thing was then to go to grad school.
So the post-bac you did, it looks like a beautiful cul-de-sac, but in the end it's a dead end. So you have to go on. So
Right. Where
did you apply to grad school? What were your thoughts? I mean, obviously you finished with physics and a minor in dance. What was your next step from there?
Oh, right. So I was sure that I wasn't going to get into grad school, that I wasn't good enough to go. Berkeley had definitely beat into me a sense of imposter syndrome.
Wow. That's fascinating because most people hearing your story, so most people don't go to Berkeley or any place nearly as prestigious. And they would think, you know, someone graduating from Berkeley must have a real confident sense of themselves, like they're very good. And you're saying almost the exact opposite of what most people would expect.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I definitely finished with a huge imposter syndrome. So I ended up, and this is part of the reason I didn't want to do physics again, because I didn't think I was any good at it. I think also in my mind, I just wanted to go back to Israel and see what life was like there. And they have a different sort of attitude towards life. Here, you know, we're very career focused. There, you know, your career is just a means to support yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I liked that sort of mentality a little bit more.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So I was thinking I'll go back to Israel, and my mom's like, what are you going to do if you go back to Israel? And I was like, well, I'll go to grad school. And she's like, well, can't you go to grad school in the U.S.? And I was like, all right, here's our deal.
So you and your mom have to negotiate again, it sounds like.
That's right. We renegotiate.
Okay.
When you have a Jewish mother. Mom, I love you if you listen to this. Not to worry.
Hi, Mom.
Hi, Mom. You're the best. You're the reason I am today what I am and where I am. So, yeah, so I went and I was like, well, I'm only going to apply to like the top programs. And I'd been working with a professor in the astronomy department. So I applied to programs in astronomy because that's where I had a couple publications. And then I was like, if I don't get into any schools in the U.S., you know, and I'm only applying to top 10 schools, then I'll go back to Israel and do a graduate program there.
Okay.
I was pretty sure that, you know, having done some research with them, they knew who I was. And again, it's a little bit different of a system. You know, I was reasonably confident that I could be a grad student there. But lo and behold, I got into grad school here, so I lost that bet with my mother.
Okay, so where did you get accepted?
I got into University of Colorado, University of Arizona.
And you chose the University of Arizona?
Right, correct.
Was it just a better fit? Was that why? Was the research more interesting? What was the thought process?
I chose Arizona because the weather was better.
Okay, simple.
I went to Colorado and it was like, well, there were a couple things. Boulder, I thought that if I was ever going to leave Berkeley, it would be for Boulder, that Boulder was like the Berkeley of Colorado. And I got there and it wasn't quite what I'd imagined.
Nope.
First of all, there was a foot or two of snow on the ground.
Yeah.
And secondly, it was a little bit smaller than, you know, the urban area I'd been used to. Yeah. And so I think just I liked Arizona on a number of levels much more. And I met some people at Arizona that I thought I could really see myself working with, whereas I didn't get to meet those people. I didn't really meet those people in Colorado.
Okay. And what was your official degree in Arizona? Was it astronomy?
Yeah. So I got to Arizona. And to put a good public face on it, I got into the astronomy program. It just really wasn't a good match.
Okay.
On a number of different levels. So I got my master's. I'd been accepted into a PhD program, but I ended up just getting my master's and leaving after that.
Okay. So it sounds like you got a master's, but they don't offer terminal master's necessarily.
Right.
Is that correct?
Yeah,
So for people who don't know, so when someone refers to within the world of like PhDs and master's programs, if someone says we offer a terminal master's program, it means they have a standalone master's program they'll offer you. But usually in PhD programs, or often in PhD programs, they do not offer a standalone master's program. But if someone does enough coursework in the course of a few years, then they might sometimes create like an exception or have some framework by which they can give you a master's for doing all that work, a master's level of work. Is that kind of what happened in your case?
That's exactly what
okay.
happened. Right?
Got it. Okay. So then you did it. You have a master's in astronomy. It wasn't quite a good fit. And then you found a new fit within the University of Arizona.
That's right. So another crossroads of what am I going to do with the rest of my life? But it came in very quickly. A lot of the research, and perhaps part of the reason it just wasn't a good fit in astronomy, is that I was actually doing a lot of, I was doing some instrument building, and I was working on something that was a little bit more electrical engineering based anyway. And so I'd been taking classes in electrical engineering. And so I started to know some of the faculty over there because I thought it'd be helpful for my research. And I was talking about my different options and what to do. And, you know, the faculty there were like, well, why don't you try this program? And I was like, that's a great idea. Mm-hmm. So I ended up applying and getting into the PhD program in electrical engineering at the University of Arizona. And that was just a perfect match for what I was actually doing as a researcher and, you know, my mathematical background and abilities. And it was just, it just worked.
So, I mean, so far, you know, what I've heard in your story, I mean, you know, Indiana, you grew up, Berkeley, a year at community college, Berkeley, Israel, which is, you know, a lifetime of experiences, back to Berkeley, now in Arizona. But how did you eventually, get to the point I'm using radios to investigate the universe, specifically studying the star formation in the Milky Way? I mean, what were the pieces that brought you to that research question and that, you know, basic sentence? I use radios to study the Milky Way, star formation in the Milky Way.
Yeah, so I had been working with an undergraduate I'd been working with a professor doing research at UC Berkeley. And we did she had me working on data from the Very Large Array, which is in Socorro, New Mexico. It's like 27 radio telescopes, and they all are combined to make one, and it's called an interferometer. So basically, you have the you have the spatial resolution that's of a satellite dish or of a telescope from one tip to the other tip of the array. So you can space these things out and have a really good detailed picture, spatial picture. And so that's what kind of got me into the idea of radio astronomy. And, you know, I think also going back to this, what I was talking about, this Saturday school that I went to in eighth grade on, you know, the light and waves of, or particles and waves of physics, and or particles and waves of light, pardon me, that was a physics course. And, you know, kind of putting all that together, I developed this fascination with the idea of doing radio astronomy and this idea of building radios and really high frequency radios.
What's a high frequency radio for someone, you know,
the problem is like all these people at what I consider low frequencies got to define high frequencies, and they're, you know, an order of magnitude lower. So I'm working in what's called the terahertz region.
Okay.
Referred to as the submillimeter region, and it's between microwave and infrared radiation.
Okay. Excellent. So you wanted to work in that particular space. You wanted to use that in that space because you wanted to develop tools to help you do other things? Were you interested in tool development?
Right. So I wanted to work in that area because that's where molecules in the star formation process radiate.
Okay.
But really, I just wanted to work on radio astronomy. So I was going to be pleased no matter where I was on the electromagnetic spectrum if I was in radio astronomy. But I will say that this really cool project popped up that my PhD advisor had, which was flying a balloon in Antarctica with a telescope on it. And I just really fell in love with the idea of working on that project. And I think that's what ended up pushing me towards that research.
So did you end up going to Antarctica for this research?
Yes.
Oh my goodness. That's a thrill of a lifetime. It must've been. What kind of things did you do there? I mean, you obviously got to Antarctica. Was it through Argentina?
Yeah, we went down through Christchurch, New Zealand. You fly commercially to Christchurch, and then you take a C-17 or a C-130 from Christchurch to the base in Antarctica, McMurdo. That's where we were stationed. There's also another base at the South Pole that a lot of people go to, but the balloon program is in McMurdo.
Okay. And how long were you there altogether?
I went down twice. Each time was 10-week deployment.
Oh my goodness, that's fantastic. So what was the experience like? I mean, just for the average human, like visually, it must have been super striking. And then what was your research?
Yeah, so visually, there's no plant life. So imagine all those trees and then imagine them gone. It's just white and blue sky all the way around you. In terms of animal life, there are some seals. We did see penguins later on in the season. They're really cute. The first time I went down, I saw both emperor penguins and Adelies. The second time I saw Adelies, but several of them.
Okay.
And, so while we were down there, so what happens is you build this instrument, and in fact, we were building an entire observatory. We had, you know, the telescope, the gondola, everything except the balloon, you know, the communications, all of that. So we were building an observatory that was going to fly. So you build it, and then you show NASA that it works, and then you have to take it all apart again to ship it down there. You don't ship it in one piece. So you get down there, you have to rebuild it and test it back out again. So we were essentially doing that.
Okay, so it's like putting a Lego set together twice, but obviously much more complicated.
Yeah, right. And you want to make sure that, because you've got pretty sensitive equipment, that nothing was damaged on the way down. And of course, that is always the case. You find something, so you end up having to, you know, swap parts, and that can be precarious if you break, you know, very little coax cables or something like that. It can. So it's a lot of fine detailed work.
Wow. So it was through these two 10-week deployments down to Antarctica that you really found this thing you wanted to work on, which is the radio spectra, you said?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
At this time, let's hear from our sponsor. This People Behind the PhDs episode is sponsored by Harp Concepts. Are you an up-and-coming artist with a bright idea? Are you a startup company who needs to prove your concept? Or are you a person who likes to personalize special gifts? Harp Concepts makes high-quality 3D models for a fraction of the price of big-name companies. Learn more at harpconcepts.com. That's harpconcepts.com.
But you ended up finishing your PhD at University of Arizona. What was your research on in particular, at least to do your dissertation?
Well, so the title of my dissertation was Heterodynarrays for Terahertz Astronomy. So essentially, I worked on that balloon project. Unfortunately, we had a number of complications the first time around, so that didn't go into very much my PhD. I'd simultaneously been working on a ground-based instrument called SuperCam.
Okay.
Which showed up, I guess, a lot on my my Google search.
In the research I did for this interview, yes, SuperCam actually is the number one word that appears in all of your research.
So that was a ground-based receiver. That's 64 pixels. That may not sound like a lot because your camera has megapixels now, but it. A heterodyne pixel is a lot more complicated than what's in your camera because you need to have both a, you know, not just a color come back, but you've got to record the wave that's coming in. So you're actually looking at the frequency, the actual wave of the light. So at the time, this was the largest heterodyne receiver on Earth. And that was designed to look at carbon monoxide. There was a transition at 345 gigahertz, or is it 340 gigahertz? So we designed the receiver to look at 345 gigahertz. And what happens is when you use the heterodyne system, you beat two frequencies together. It's like playing a note out of tune, and you get their beat frequency up. So we were really looking at the beat frequency in order to, and this is the way all of our instruments work, in order to have a signal that's at much lower frequency, that we can sample and record and then come up, you know, build up our pictures, build up our cameras of the sky, or our pictures of the sky from that camera.
So these are the frequencies that help build the 3D pictures you're making?
That's right, yeah.
Okay.
And then I went to the Netherlands for 6 months and I got to work on a receiver at 4.9 terahertz. So that's a factor of 10 larger than 340 gigahertz. And so we were interested in that for looking at neutral oxygen. So we were looking at the neutral oxygen line. And as you go higher and higher in frequency, it gets harder and harder to build these heterodyne receivers because you need something called a local oscillator. You need to generate a lab signal that's a much higher frequency, and that's just hard to do. So,
did you discover anything in particular while working in Holland, or were you on a team that helped discover anything in particular?
Yeah. So we were successful in building this receiver. It was noise in your receiver is very important. You want to minimize that so that you have as much signal to noise as possible. It also scales as frequency, so your signal to noise gets worse as your frequency goes up, which is another reason it gets a lot more difficult to build these instruments at higher frequencies. So at the time, we had definitely measured the best, or built the receiver with the best measured, it's called a noise temperature, which tells you about the amount of noise above 3 terahertz. So that was pretty exciting. And that was published in Applied Physics Letters.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic. So for people who don't know, can you just tell them about the distinction between signal and noise?
Well, yes. Yeah. So your signal is the frequency that you're trying to tune into. That's the signature of your molecule. That's, you know, when you're tuning in your radio, you know, you get a bunch of static, you hear a lot of static, and then the radio station comes in loud and clear. Well, that static is still there. It's just that your signal from your radio station is so much stronger, you only hear the signal from the radio station. But if you're...
That's fantastic. So for people who don't know, can you just tell them about the distinction between signal and noise?
Well, yes. Yeah. So your signal is the frequency that you're trying to tune into. That's the signature of your molecule. That's, you know, when you're tuning in your radio, you know, you get a bunch of static, you hear a lot of static, and then the radio station comes in loud and clear. Well, that static is still there. It's just that your signal from your radio station is so much stronger, you only hear the signal from the radio station. But if your signal from your radio station isn't that strong, then you start to hear both the static and the signal together. And so the idea is to make a receiver that can hear that signal nice and loud and clear.
And turns down the noise then as well, as it were.
Well, yes, exactly.
So noise could be signals from another molecule, but if you're not trying to tune into that particular molecule, then it's noise. So it's the distinction is what you're trying to tune into, and if you're able to find your way into that particular molecule in this case. Is that...
Well, there's a number of different contributors to the noise, and we'll have to do another podcast on that one day if you want to talk about that. One of them is the noise from the atmosphere. But in fact, because the noise from the atmosphere at 4.7 terahertz is so great, you have to fly this instrument. You can't do any ground observations. So essentially we're looking at noise from the detectors themselves. We were trying to evaluate the sensitivity of the detector itself. So
as a proxy for something, for...
No, it's just you have a number of contributors to the noise. You know, you've got amplifier noise, you've got device noise, so the detector noise, you're going to have a filter noise, you're going to have atmospheric noise. There's just so many different contributors.
So you try to subtract all these sources of noise out in order to have a signal remaining that you can actually work with.
Right. But in order to do that, the best thing to do is just build a really sensitive receiver.
Okay. That's the big workaround. Like, yeah, that's all nice, but let's just build a better receiver.
Yeah, because, I mean, calibrating out all of those things, you do what you can. I mean, you do some calibration measurements, but at the end of the day, if your signal's not louder than your noise, you have to integrate for a very long time, meaning you have to observe your object for a lot longer than if... Because if the signal's always there and the noise is random, which is true, that means that eventually, if you look at something long enough, you will build up a strong signal in your data, but it can take a very long amount of time. And if you're flying something on space, in space, that's expensive, right? That's observationally expensive.
Yeah.
You want to build up as many sources as possible, build up as large a data set as possible. So you want to be able to observe as many things as you can quickly.
Excellent. So two more questions, Dr. Klosterman. Okay. So when we were early in the conversation, you were talking about when you changed from being a dancer between your freshman year to taking up the violin. And, you know, you said it was really fascinating to try to find a note when playing the violin. You said that relates to what you're doing now. How does that relate to what you're doing now?
Well, it's just that I mean, I guess I was just trying to make an analogy between the fact that, you know, it's very obvious on a stringed instrument, but, you know, in all instruments, you know, when you're running your bow across the string, you're creating a vibration in that string, and that's creating a wave. And so, you know, we're looking at waves. Kind of like that in the Milky Way. So that's called a longitudinal wave, and we're looking at a transverse wave, but it's the same idea. They operate in the same way in terms of how you detect them, how you record them. So the idea is you're listening to a frequency on your violin, you know, or we're listening to a frequency in space.
So you're using the frequencies and the waves in order to figure out the source?
No, we know what the source is.
You know what the source is.
We're trying to figure out how the source is moving. We're trying to build up a kinematic picture of the cloud.
And what's kinematic for people who don't know?
I mean, kinematic is like how you move.
Okay.
So that means velocity. Okay,
kinesthetic. That's related to that move. That
yeah,
word. Okay.
Right, exactly. So velocities, pressures, you know, that's what I think of when I think of kinematic, velocity and pressure. So
for one example could be, you know, the source in, for example, like the clouds somewhere in the Milky Way, whatever region you're studying, and you're using the signals and the waves from these clouds to figure out some things about them.
Good question. That's a good way to bring it all together. So based on calculations, we can figure out what the rest frequency of the molecule should be. So the rest frequency being like, if you're tuning the radio station, you would expect to see it at this particular frequency right here. But in actuality, we don't see it right at that frequency. You see it a little bit offset, because if you think about the Doppler shift, if something's moving away from you, it has a lower pitch. And if something's moving closer to you, it has a higher pitch. So when we're tuning our radio, we actually don't see the signal right at 345 gigahertz or 340 gigahertz. We might say 341 or 339. And that tells us what the velocity is. That there's an equation that relates that frequency to the rest frequency and gives you out the velocity.
Okay, and that gives you important information, obviously.
Yeah. Well, basically, we're applying the Doppler shift. We're looking at the Doppler shift of our line.
Okay, excellent. So one more question, Dr. Klusterman. So if someone came to you, maybe this happens to you because you're an assistant professor, they say, I would like to do a PhD someday.
Yeah.
What do you tell someone who says they want to do a PhD someday?
I have many, many pieces of wisdom. First of all, do as much research as you can before you apply to grad school. These days, you're competing with a bunch of other people that have also done as much research as you can. The other thing is have some confidence in yourself. But if you really look at some of the averages and getting into some of these programs and you feel like, boy, you know, their students have a 3.9 GPA and I only have a 3.5. Don't say, oh, I'm never going to be able to do this. Take a look at all the other different ways you could do that PhD. For example, if you're interested in doing an astronomy PhD, but it turns out that, you know, to get into the astronomy program at Arizona, you need a 3.9 GPA. But to get into the physics program, you only need a 3.5. Well, maybe you apply to physics then and then do astronomy from the physics department. That's an example of you know, what I would suggest if you, you know, if you're really nervous about, you know, whether or not you're going to get in. Now, obviously, I did get into the astronomy program, and then it wasn't a great match. So don't necessarily limit yourself to what you originally thought you were going to do either. You know, keep an open mind and know that life has an interesting path set for you, or if you, or just, you know, that that there's more than one way to get to what you want to do.
Absolutely. And then one more question. I promised that was the last one, but since you indirectly brought it up, earlier you talked about the imposter syndrome at Berkeley. And obviously at this point in your life, you have a PhD. So it's the greatest academic accomplishment someone can have. Well, at least before a postdoc, let's say. What got you over the imposter syndrome? Because a lot of people run around in the world with imposter syndromes, like I'm not good enough to do X. What got you over that?
Oh, I still have it. I think it's just, you know, eventually you do things enough times, you repeat them enough times, you've seen it before, you've developed an intuition. But there are, you know, there are some things I'm pretty confident about, but there are other times when I really, you know, I feel like an imposter.
Okay, so it's something that sticks with you. You just learn how to live with it better.
Yeah, you learn how to hide it a little bit better, maybe.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, excellent. So Jenna, thanks so much for being on the show today. I really appreciate your time and sharing some of your knowledge with us.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. So thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to part 3 of the interview with Dr. Jenna Kloosterman, who builds radios to provide 3D pictures of the sky. To continue listening, visit drz.net. That's dr-z.net. You can also follow me on Facebook at Dr. Z Podcasts and Instagram at drznet. As always, happy deciding. People Behind the PhDs is conceived, written, produced, and edited by Dr. Z, that's me, Zachary Brooks, PhD, in Dr. Z Productions and Podcasts. Learn more at drz.net/about. That's dr-z.net/about.